I'm happy to welcome on behalf of the court Newman High School students. Would they please stand? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. And we also have MATC business law students. Would they stand, please? It's good having you here, too. You may be seated. The high school students are here with us with a program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. The program is entitled Court with Class. High school students are invited to come to an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they're given the briefs of the case, and they may have done additional work on this case to prepare them for oral argument. Now, for those who have not received the briefs, there is a summary of this case out on the table in the foyer, and we encourage you to get that summary and read it, because I think you'll better understand the case as you will listen to it. The students are also given the opportunity to meet with a justice after this second case is over and talk about the process that the court uses to decide cases, not the substance of the case, and everyone is welcome to attend that session with the justice. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far right is an empty chair, and Justice Sykes ordinarily sits there. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser. And you will be meeting with Justice Prosser after this case is over. And on the far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. With these introductions made, we'll proceed to our second case today, State versus Thornton, 01-1402, representing the petitioner, William Thornton, is Robert R. Hennick. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Hennick, and I do represent William Thornton on this appeal. The central issue before the Court is not whether Mr. Thornton is being subjected to unconstitutional deprivation of his liberty. The State concedes that, at least to the extent of the 4.5 years imposed as a result of the weapons enhancers on the drug count. Rather, the central issue before this Court is whether Mr. Thornton's ignorance of the legal claim, his ignorance of the reason why that custody is unconstitutional, whether that should deprive him of the right to challenge the unconstitutionality of the custody. In essence, what we are here to resolve is what is the meaning of the phrase sufficient reason in 97406 sub 4 of the Wisconsin statutes. Now, this Court has, and the Court of Appeals have already established certain examples of what would constitute sufficient reason. For instance, ineffectiveness of post-conviction or appellate counsel, situations in which someone is challenging the effectiveness of the attorney who represented them at both the trial and on appeal, the incompetency of the defendant, that's a sufficient reason under Deborah A.E., where the legal basis for the claim was not known or established prior to the previous post-conviction motion, that's a sufficient reason under Howard. However, this Court and the Court of Appeals have never really addressed the more general issue of what analysis is the Court to apply in determining whether a proffered reason for not raising an issue in a prior motion is indeed, quote, sufficient, close quotes. And that, of course, is an issue of statutory interpretation, looking at the original legislative intent. To summarize our position, however, or to clarify our position, what we are arguing for is basically the standard set out in Price v. Johnston, the U.S. Supreme Court case from 1948, which is the Court is permitted to review a case and grant relief if the defendant presents a fair and just reason to overlook the fact that the issue either was not raised in the prior proceeding or that it was inadequately presented in the prior proceeding. This is an issue of the sound discretion of the trial court, with certain specific situations in which the reason is sufficient as a matter of law. Those reasons which the court has already found, in effect in this post-conviction counsel, things like that, would fall within that category. Those are sufficient reasons as a matter of law.
But in that case, counsel, just so I know, that the fair and just reason is ignorance of the law, if I guess then that's the state's position. In the case you cite, was that on point as far as lack of knowledge?
Yes.
So it was a subjective? I mean, in order to determine whether someone knows or doesn't know, it's a subjective, it's not objective.
Yes.
Okay.
And I believe that that is fully consistent with this Court's decision in Howard, in which the Court emphasized that Howard did not, in fact, know the legal basis for his Peet claim, even though technically, from an objective point of view, Howard would have had exactly the same tools to work with that Peet's attorney did earlier. So I believe that under Howard that this Court does already apply a subjective standard to that. And the Price v. Johnson decision also specifically addressed the issue where the defendant did not, in fact, have the knowledge of the underlying facts or the legal basis for his claim. And the Court said that under those circumstances, the federal court in that case was required to actually consider the new claim, even though the defendant had raised other claims in other motions previously.
What if any significance in getting away a little bit from Peet Howard, which is we're talking about the nexus of the weapon to the predicate offense, would this have on other situations if we were to say that we're going to have a subjective standard and it's going to be a fair and just reason? What does this do to Escalano?
It doesn't do anything to Escalano.
You think
it is fully consistent with Escalano, especially since when you look at the decision in Escalano, the specific language that the Court is using, the Court only discussed sufficient reason in basically two contexts. One, in a footnote affirming the Klimas, State v. Klimas view of sufficient reason, which is where there's an intervening change in the law. The second, in holding that Mr. Escalano and Arano did not have a sufficient reason because at the time of his initial appeal, he, in fact, raised two allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel and also knew that his attorney had not properly objected to the particular evidence at issue in that case, but chose, and the Court uses that language, but chose not to raise that at the time of his initial appeal. Also later in the Escalona decision, the Court says something to the effect that we should not encourage litigants to strategically withhold certain claims or not to raise claims of which they have knowledge, that kind of language. So my position, which is basically the standard set forth in Sanders v. United States and Faye v. Noya, and as well as Price v. Johnston, is that if the defendant did not personally have knowledge of either the factual basis for the claim or the legal basis for the claim and make a conscientious choice to withhold it in the prior proceeding, then he has sufficient reason to raise it in a subsequent proceeding.
Counselor, if that's the rule, isn't a defendant always better being his own lawyer because he's probably never going to have knowledge of most of the claims that you have to bring in court?
An individual who is incarcerated or in custody is never better off being his own lawyer because he's going to miss those kind of things and he's going to end up in custody longer. Even when he does present them, he is not going to, in most cases, present them as well. And even a valid claim can be missed if it is not presented well.
So what you're telling us is there are probably two different standards then. If someone is operating pro se, there's one standard and the other one is if he has a lawyer.
Actually, if we look at the standards under Faye v. Noya and Sanders, the U.S. Supreme Court cases, there is not a separate standard. In fact, if the defendant does not personally know of the claim, even if his lawyer did, it is sufficient reason. to come back. There is not a separate standard. And the reason why I refer to these federal cases, obviously, they were addressing the federal habeas standard. This Court isn't applying federal habeas. It's applying 97406. But what we have to assess is what is the meaning of sufficient reason. We look at the history of that, and that, as the Court knows, was derived from Section 8 of the Uniform Post-Conviction Procedures Act, and as the Court held in Escalon and Araño, therefore, we have to look at the purpose and legislative history of Section 8 of that act.
Mr. Hennig, how would the State ever meet and dispute a claim if it's a subjective test? You've got a prisoner getting up on the stand and saying, gee, I didn't know about case X, Y, Z. How would the State ever dispute that?
Well, there are, for instance, I can't remember the exact, I think it's Long Dunn or something like that, the U.S. Supreme Court discussed in Sanders one of the situations in which a defendant actually raises two issues in his first habeas petition, and he simply doesn't present evidence on that. He, you know, withdraws it. In that case, obviously, he has made an intelligent choice or a conscientious choice. In any kind of a factual setting or any kind of factual allegations in a 97406 motion, the defendant still has to prove that. And the prosecutor can get up, can cross-examine that individual about what he knew, what he didn't know, when he found out, what the facts were, you know, that resulted in him finding out. Whether he had ever discussed this with anybody else before, the same kind of cross-examination that the State is able to do with regard to any factual allegation in a 97406 motion.
Don't you think an objective test makes more sense? I'm just thinking about some of the facts involved here. You've got the Peet decision, as I understand it, in 1994. You've got your client bringing a motion under 974.06 in 1995, well after the Peet decision. The issue isn't raised under an objective approach. It would seem that the bottom line would be the decision was there. You're charged with some knowledge in regard to such a decision, especially where you're represented by counsel, and therefore you're out of luck. Doesn't that appear to make more sense than a subjective test?
Not to my mind. What we are talking about, after all, is whether an individual who is being unconstitutionally deprived of their liberty should be able to assert that right and obtain relief. So we have to, first of all, we have to do a balance between the interest in finality and the interest in justice in a particular case.
Well, how does the fact that he's represented by an attorney enter into the process?
If he is represented by an attorney, number one, you can assume that the attorney will have researched, you know, many of these things or will have knowledge about them and will have discussed the issues with the individual. They don't necessarily do that, and that's something that can be alleged in a post-conviction motion if they haven't, to show that there was no subjective knowledge. But in answer to your original question of whether this is better objective is better than subjective, looking at this particular case, for instance, the problem that the State has in disproving his subjective lack of knowledge is the facts. You know, here we have somebody who has absolutely no reason not to raise an issue in the April 1998 pro se motion. If he knew of them, he had every reason to raise them. But he didn't, and we can assume from that, I think that is that corroborates his assertion that he didn't, in fact, know of it until later. When he, in fact, did learn of it, he made every effort to try to raise it, first trying to remand it as early as, I think it was 2 months, less than 2 months after the April 98 motion was filed. He made a motion requesting to remand the case so he could raise this issue. He subsequently filed two attempts at 97406 motions while the earlier issue was on appeal. They lacked jurisdiction. The circuit court lacked jurisdiction and dismissed those. He tried to brief it in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said it wouldn't accept that brief because it wasn't raised in the circuit court. He made all of these efforts, you know, he attempted to get counsel appointed to do that. He made all of these efforts, which are fully inconsistent with the suggestion that he, in fact, knew of it in April and strategically tried to withhold it. So just on the facts of this case, there isn't any problem with, you know, establishing subjective lack of knowledge.
Why didn't you allege ineffective assistance of counsel? Because counsel in the first 97406 motion did not refer to Pete, which had already been handed down. Now, I know Howard didn't come until later saying it was retroactive, but at least that's an obvious, I put in quotes, issue for a lawyer as to whether or not a particular decision is retroactive. And so it could have been raised at that time. I mean, Howard raised it later.
Mm-hmm.
Counsel could have raised it here.
Yes.
And so why aren't you here on that ground?
Well, the number one reason I'm not here on that ground is because Mr. Thornton did not raise them in his his pro se motions, and I was only appointed for the petition for review to this court, and so there was no allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel. Second, although it's not established, it is generally accepted that there is no constitutional right to the effective assistance of counsel on a 97406 petition. You're entitled to the right to counsel on a direct appeal. There perhaps can be an argument raised that an attorney making an unreasonable mistake on a 97406 petition could be a sufficient reason. We haven't raised that here because Mr. Thornton did not raise that below. It was not asserted.
Because it's not a constitutional right, then ineffective assistance is not an effective defense. That's your point.
Constitutional ineffectiveness of ineffective assistance. I would suggest, however, although it's not directly at issue in this case, that the legislative history of Section 8 of the Uniform Post-Conviction Procedures Act suggests that we do not have to get to constitutional ineffectiveness in order to make out sufficient reason. The U.S. Supreme Court in Murray v. Currier held that any allegation that a lawyer screwed up, that's from 1986, that any allegation that you didn't do what you were supposed to do, you didn't meet the procedural requirements because your lawyer screwed up, the Supreme Court in that case held that for purposes of federal habeas corpus, attorney's actions have to be adjudged or evaluated on a constitutional ineffectiveness standard. However, when we look at the legislative history for Section 8 of the Post-Conviction Procedures Act, it refers to the earlier Supreme Court decisions in Saunders and Favey Noya as setting the appropriate standard that they were trying to codify in that sufficient reason standard.
I have another question about appellate practice. I confess that I was surprised that the Court of Appeals didn't stay and send it back to the trial court, or didn't accept a brief. Court of Appeals apparently has discretion to handle issues that have been waived or not presented.
Yes. And I have
the usual practice that the Court of Appeals hangs tough like this, or is this a hang tough because there's pro se and we're trying to make sure that pro se criminal defendants stay out of the courts?
I would not attribute either. I would not attribute to the Court of Appeals an intent to keep pro se litigants out of court. I do not know the reason why they did not grant the remand in this case. I know that in at least two or three of my own cases, I have made motions to remand while an appeal has been pending and those have been granted. I've never had one denied.
Well, he didn't know how to make a motion.
No.
Or did he? He sort of made it.
He sort of made the motion, and actually, you know, as a matter of fact, he did realize that he had to allege sufficient reason for not having raised this issue earlier. He alleged the sufficient reason that he had, that he was ignorant of this issue until after the prior motion had been decided. As far as pro se litigants go, he did a pretty good job. But even with that, he lost, and The issue before this Court is an important one. He identified an important issue. The Court of Appeals ruled one way. The dissent suggested another, and that's why we are here.
Is there any relationship between the Price versus Johnston case, which you cited, decided in 1948, and the 28 U.S.C. 2255 passed in 1948?
Yes, I believe that they, the discussion later in Favinoia is that, you know, it followed and basically implemented, the 2255 basically implemented the rules of Price v. Johnston. There was in 2255 a very, very vague abuse of the writ type standard, just saying that the court need not consider a subsequent or successive attempt to raise the same issue. In Favinoia, I believe it was, the Supreme Court said that that has the same that is the same standard as in 2254, or as applied in 2254 cases, which is that if you raised an issue before, you had it ruled on, that you could not, you could raise it again, but the judge could deny it unless there is a showing of good cause or whatever why it shouldn't be heard. There was nothing in 2255 or in 2254 throughout the 50s and early 60s which specifically addressed the issue here, whether successive petitions raising separate or distinct issues, new issues. That was addressed in the Sanders decision, in which the Supreme Court basically said that as long as the defendant did not deliberately bypass or did not deliberately withhold an issue from the prior proceeding, that he is entitled to present it.
Now, should you prevail, what happens here?
Should I prevail? Number one, the Pete Howard claim, we would strike 4.5 years off of the sentence. And that's basically all that would happen other than that the state would have a right to retry Mr. Thornton on the weapons enhancer pursuant to this court's decision in Pete. If you are looking for the broader view of what happens here, then I can also address that.
Why don't you give me the broad one?
Okay. The broader result of this is there may be some additional meritorious 97406 cases. No one who is not entitled to relief will be granted relief, because I'm not saying that you have to hear a case and grant relief to someone who doesn't have a right to relief on the merits. The main thing that will happen here is that those people, such as Mr. Thornton, who are unconstitutionally detained, will have a right to relief on those if he is able to show sufficient reason. In a broader sense, right now we have sufficient reason. One of the sufficient reasons that is authorized or acknowledged by the court is ineffectiveness of post-conviction or appellate counsel. As this court will remember from our discussion last year in the Lowe case, Judge Deininger's dissent about the layers of the onion and how bringing motions alleging the ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel basically turns the whole process into a peeling of onions, a peeling away at excess work and effort on the part of the parties in the court. If my position is accepted here, I think that a lot of those are going to go by the wayside, because defendants will not have to allege ineffectiveness of post-conviction or appellate counsel. If they did not know of the issue at the time of the prior proceeding or the prior post-conviction motion, they will be able to raise it on its merits and get a decision on its merits without having to go through this song and dance about whether it was ineffectiveness of counsel or what. You just go straight to the merits and decide them. As the commissioners for the Uniform Act pointed out in their discussion, that is actually better for everyone, that you're actually going to save time by addressing issues such as these on the merits, getting rid of the ones that are meritless, granting the ones that need to be granted, rather than trying to, quote, save judicial time and effort by having these procedural...
Now you've gone too far, Mr. Hennick.
Yep. Okay.
Counselor, can you tell me if Gordon has any bearing on the reckless endangerment conviction?
Yes, it has direct bearing on that. If Gordon stands, then I lose. It would not have an effect on the other two. Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, but I disagree with Gordon for the reasons stated in the dissent, but this Court already has decided that, so I'm not going to waste the Court's time.
Thank you.
It goes too far, Mr. Hennig, because if you take that argument to its farthest boundary, then forget about multiple concept that you shouldn't come to the Court multiple times, just and each of them just handle the merits and get rid of it. That's why it goes too far. So somehow you have to cabin that.
Yes.
You don't want to let prisoners or anyone else come to the Court time and time and time and time again, figuring sometime they may hit pay dirt. And that's one of the purposes of the 97406. On the other hand, finality is not the only criteria, only value. And innocence, or put it another way, you don't want somebody imprisoned unlawfully. So why can't this case be limited to the concept that where it's clear on the record and without dispute? Now I'm going to ask the State this, but I don't think the State disputes that the convictions for the while armed, that is the enhancement, are invalid under Pete Howard. State another way, State, I think, agrees these are invalid under Pete Howard. So we have undisputed invalid sentences here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why can't the case just stand for where it's undisputed that the conviction on part of or whole of these crimes are to be set aside, even if this is his 100th claim, if on the face of it the State and you agree it's invalid? That seems quite simple to me, and it sort of fits with the current debate in the U.S. Supreme Court about whether if somebody appears to be not guilty, you open up the, and I think these are come up in death cases, death penalty cases. No matter what happens, if the guy looks innocent, you just don't let him get to whatever method of killing the State uses. So what do you say about that?
On behalf of Mr. Thornton, I will take anything that grants him the relief. On the broader view of this, I want to emphasize that what we are trying to do is assess what the legislature intended in 1969 when it enacted this statute. And in doing that, we look to the legislative intent at that time, untainted by what happened, you know, the last 30 years. The trend toward elevating finality over justice in the U.S. Supreme Court, for instance, is irrelevant to that, because at the time that the legislature enacted this, there was no cause and prejudice standard.
What about the Prisoner Reform Act that we have, similar to the feds?
Yes, but I don't believe that that applies to 97406 cases.
Okay.
And I see that my time is out, so.
Thank you, Mr. Hennig. Mr. Gansner, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Happy to see you again. Weren't you here yesterday?
Excuse me?
Weren't you here yesterday?
It just seems like a moment ago.
Welcome.
I believe it was Tuesday.
Okay, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, he has a different tie on. I noticed that.
Yes, I did. Thank you. With the blue to red. Bert doesn't miss a thing.
I miss that.
I appreciate Mr. Hennig's statement on addressing, attempting to address the larger issue that is involved in this case. This court decided Escalona in 1994. Last year, in State versus Lowe, this court dealt with and rejected arguments that were seeking to overrule Escalona. The defendant's mission in Lowe, this court said, was not to attempt to find the best way to implement Escalona. His mission was to bury the case. This court rejected that attempt and reaffirmed, I think in clear and unmistakable terms, the rule of Escalona-Naranjo. Now, a year later, with the funeral having been canceled, this court deals with what, while the defendant describes his arguments in more modest terms, I think should nonetheless be understood as being, if not an attempt to bury Escalona, an attempt to drastically change it.
Oh, you think Escalona is sick?
No, I don't think it's sick. I think it's a vital and important rule. I think it enforces both a fair balance between fairness to defendants and the societal interest in finality and, frankly, the court's and society's interest in ensuring that issues are dealt with in a timely fashion and that piecemeal litigation does not encumber the courts and delay the attaining of a finality that, frankly, while it may be presumptuous for me to say so, I believe not only society desires, but that the defendant ought to obtain as well. That is to say, there comes a time when society has a reasonable expectation that litigation over a conviction ought to come to an end.
Counsel, before you proceed further, if you should not prevail, do you agree that the conviction and sentence on the enhancements are invalid?
We've agreed that if the defendant is entitled to raise the Howard Pete nexus claim, that on two of the three counts, the two drug counts, that he would be entitled pursuant to a retroactive application of Pete pursuant to Howard, he'd be entitled to a reduction of his sentence.
Is that the 4.5 years?
Right. Okay. He would not be entitled to challenge the sentence as a result of Gordon. He would not be entitled to challenge the sentence.
Here's my point. What is the public safety, public interest in finality and fairness of keeping somebody in prison 4.5 years when, under the laws of the state, it is invalid to do so?
In any individual case, it will be difficult for the state to argue that a societal interest is furthered by a particular defendant not being able to obtain the benefit of a change in the law that the court has held should be retroactively applied. The larger issue in this case is what we do to the rule of Escalona. And I believe in the larger context and in the aggregate, the change that the defendant is arguing for in Escalona would do substantial damage to our understanding of the fair balance between fairness to defendants and the interest in the finality of criminal convictions. Your Honor, the question was asked of Mr. Hennick, would the defendant be satisfied or happy with a ruling from this court that under a narrow ruling from this court, that in cases of, be it Pete Howard nexus, or a determination that a sentence has been imposed that is in excess of that authorized by law, that under those circumstances there ought to be an exception granted under Escalona.
Right.
The state.
I'll ask you that.
I'll give you. I'm heading to the same answer.
You're going to ask the questions and answer.
Yeah, I'm going to get to it.
It's easier that way.
Our position is exactly. Gave me a little extra time to think about it when you asked Mr. Hennig. Our answer to that is this. If this court, number one, we don't believe that it is necessary for this court to carve out exceptions for particular classes of claims.
for the same reason that particular classes of claims are not carved out as exceptions to the general rules of statute of limitations that are applicable both in criminal cases and in civil cases. The legislature has chosen to extend the statute of limitation for when you can bring a homicide prosecution to an infinite level, but the legislature imposes other rules for a limitation period on when one can bring a prosecution for other offenses. Those types of rules are, at the other end of the litigation, statutes of repose, although that term actually covers statutes of limitation as well, are rules that are designed to organize the procedure by which the courts operate and justice is attempted to be pursued. We think it is fair to hold this category of claim to the same requirement as all other categories of claim. If this court were to disagree, however, and see something unique in the circumstance of Pete Howard in a nexus claim, and limit a ruling and issue a ruling that under this peculiar, unique set of circumstances, it is appropriate to allow the defendant, even though he could have raised it earlier in an earlier 974-06 motion, to raise it in a later 974-06 motion. While the state wouldn't applaud the ruling, the state would be far happier than if this court accepts Mr. Hennick's broad argument that ignorance of the law constitutes a sufficient reason for a defendant to belatedly raise claims that he could have raised earlier.
I wanted you to expand on that because when I asked opposing counsel that question, he didn't see, in fact, he didn't think that that would in any way eviscerate Escalano. But it's a subjective standard would be, in my opinion, difficult for this court or for anyone to ascertain, particularly under these circumstances.
I agree, and then
I want you to comment on whether it's narrow, but I want to take a look at this in a global sense,
sure,
what this might affect in other areas.
Okay. Well, I think it's important for this court to, as my answer here, I think it's important for this court to focus on an important matter here that I think may have been overlooked. What we're talking about here in Mr. Thornton's case is a situation in which we don't have a situation in which he failed to raise something on a direct appeal and then sought to raise it on a subsequent 974-06 motion. I mean, he couldn't have raised the Howard Pete claim on his direct appeal. It was before Pete. Maybe he could have made the argument the way Pete did, but he didn't. And we're not contending otherwise. What this case involves is not, as this court dealt with in Escalona, the question of whether a failure to raise something on direct appeal in the absence of sufficient reason bars raising it on a 974-06 motion. What we're dealing with here is the situation that even the dissenting justices in Escalona agreed 974-06 applied to. That is, multiple 974-06 motions. An individual who raises some claims after his appeal rights have been exhausted, raises some claims on a 974-06 motion, but not the issue he later wants to raise on a later one, and then later raises, in this case, the Pete Howard claim on a subsequent 974-06. Everyone involved in the Escalona decision agreed that 974-06 applied there. And that's where the problem comes.
Time he uses 974-06, it's before Howard, right?
Mm-hmm.
In time.
Yes.
Would you say that he's knocked out then under the dissent in Escalona because he didn't raise it?
When he failed to raise it there?
Yeah, he was represented by counsel. Pete had been out. Mm-hmm. Howard had not. Counsel didn't raise it.
Right.
The state arguing that that comes under even the dissent in Escalona, that you have to bring all your eggs in one basket?
We could have argued that,
no, but
we instead presented a more limited argument, which was that the defendant was not really put on full notice of what he could raise until in Howard this court held Pete retroactive. Certainly at that point, any defendant with exercising due diligence, who's functioning as his own advocate, who has, as we know, been looking for ways to challenge his conviction because he has brought repeat motions after his conviction, one would think any reasonable advocate, self-advocate under these circumstances, ought to be recognized as having a responsibility to remain sufficiently conversant with changes in the law to have recognized 9 months after Howard held Pete fully retroactive that the claim could be made.
And you'd hold that would be the same standard you'd hold a lawyer to under a malpractice. I don't want to get into the constitutionality.
Basically. And Mr. Hennig, I think, very fairly answered, and I'd agree with his answer to the question about at least part of the answer to his question about why there wasn't a claim of ineffective assistance of his counsel in failing to raise the Pete Howard issue on the first 974-06 motion on which Mr. Thornton was represented by counsel. There is, of course, no right to collateral review. There is no constitutional right, United States constitutional right, and thus there is no Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. There's no counsel right, there's no right to effective assistance, at least under the United States Constitution. The defendant might have raised a claim that, had the state interjected an Escalona argument there, my attorney, even if not constitutionally effective, because the Constitution doesn't guarantee effectiveness here, my attorney he goofed without justification. He was lazy, he was slothful, he made a mistake, and those mistakes might be, perhaps could be asserted. He didn't do so, and Mr. Hennig acknowledges that. Instead, what we have, and I think this goes to Justice Wilcox, to your point about what the ultimate effect of Mr. Hennig's argument in this case is, instead of having a defendant who challenges the competence or the effectiveness, constitutional or otherwise, of his attorney, he is in essence saying, I'm to blame. I'm not competent. Yet we know that this was a defendant who, with some zeal, produced and brought a number of motions challenging his conviction. But most importantly, it is common in 974-06 litigation because there is no constitutional right to counsel. And because the public defender's office, my experience shows, in the case of indigent defendants, has great difficulty appointing counsel for them because they are frankly overwhelmed with their cases in which they are obliged to appoint counsel, it is common for defendants to represent themselves in 974-06.
And that's what troubles me, because if we have, because there is no right to counsel on collateral attack, then most of these will be coming up pro se. But that's why I asked about the global effect on this, on Escalano, because then the effect would be, well, if you find something later on that you forgot, then the knowledge comes in,
exactly.
How would you show a lack of knowledge?
Right, and I think this goes to a matter, Justice Wilcox, that you raised and that Justice Rogensack raised as well, which is this: because the defendant is representing himself, and because so many 974-06 motions involve pro se litigants, defendant is right that his own failure to raise an issue can constitute, because he's representing himself, a sufficient reason for being allowed to bring repeat serial 974-06 motions later, then in that limited respect at least, it would be fair to ask, if the pro se litigant is not being granted an opportunity to engage in repeat litigation, that the represented defendant is not. Now, while there may be, and the law recognizes, special reasons why we should treat some aspects of a pro se litigant's practice with a special solicitude. Thus, we have the well-established practice rule that the pleadings of a pro se litigant who's untrained in the law are to be liberally construed. But at the same time, that rule of liberal construction is designed to hold the litigant to, in essence, the same pleading requirements. That is, you have to plead sufficient facts. It's just that they will be the same pleading requirements as counsel. They'll just be more liberally construed.
Counsel, that's one of the things that concerns me about this whole discussion. The legal fiction, perhaps the necessary legal fiction, but nevertheless, arguably a legal fiction. You indicated that in the pleading stage that there is a recognition that one untrained in the law maybe needs a little leeway.
Mm-hmm.
Yet that same recognition doesn't hold true here, you're advancing. Instead, we find, as a matter of law, that a reasonable, untrained person in the law would know the law. And we engage in that fiction, I guess, in part out of a sense of judicial administration. Mm-hmm. Finality, you know, and there's a lot to be said about finality. We engage in that fiction in order to keep successive motions down, to thwart the filing of successive motion after motion. And yet here, that rationale, I'm not sure, applies. Certainly finality does. But I can conceive of no reason whatsoever that this defendant would intentionally not raise this defense. And so the rationale under which we are operating and perpetuating this fiction doesn't even seem to apply, at least partially in this case. So I've hit two points. One is the rationale in terms of successive motions doesn't apply because he had every incentive to bring it immediately and not be dilatory. And number two, the rationale of we realize a person untrained in the law can't be held at the same standard, and yet we here say it is reasonable to have a person untrained in the law to require them to know the law. How do you deal with that?
I'm uncomfortable with this to a certain extent, and that is why in my answer, I think, to the Chief's question, I answered the question that with respect to the facts of this case, you know, our concern, frankly, is much greater with the argument for the creation of a new sufficient reason, that is, the ignorance of the defendant becoming viewed as, Mr. Hennig is asking this Court to hold that the ignorance of the defendant, at least under certain circumstances that we think are far too broad, would be recognized as a new sufficient reason why an issue had not been raised before. In this particular case, I would agree to you. I mean, we've acknowledged that had this defendant brought his claim earlier, he certainly would have been entitled to receive sentencing relief. But I'm not sure that it's truly a legal fiction that we're dealing with when we say here that there ought to be some reasonable objective standard imposed upon even pro se litigants.
I don't think that it's a – I mean, I think there should be some reasonable standard, and what I am pushing on is what is reasonable, you know. I mean, and even if you can say, I can say, okay, I agree, it's an objective standard. Mm-hmm. Forget this objective. Objective standard. Mm-hmm. But if you define objective as what is a reasonably untrained person in the law expected to know, that's the rub. That's where our fiction, our legal fiction arises.
Let me try to offer some assistance here in this regard. We've suggested in our brief that the more appropriate standard to be applying in this circumstance, rather than the Fay versus Noya deliberate bypass standard, which is, of course, a standard that the United States Supreme Court and Congress has abandoned in federal habeas corpus litigation, both 2254 litigation brought by state prisoners or 2255 motions brought by federal prisoners. The deliberate bypass standard of Fay versus Noya isn't even applicable any longer. Instead, we deal in state in 2254 habeas with the question of procedural default. If a person failed to raise something in the state courts, does it bar him from raising it in federal court? Yes, it does, in the absence of his showing, in essence, a sufficient reason why he didn't raise it, cause for why he didn't, and then prejudice from failing to raise it. And the federal courts uniformly apply the view that cause constitutes not, I didn't think of it, or I was ignorant of it. In fact, the federal courts in this connection have almost uniformly rejected the notion that ignorance constitutes a sufficient reason. They have instead said that the cause that will be sufficient to excuse your failure to have raised something should really be something external to the defense. That is to say, for instance, in the pro se prisoner context, there was some factor or intervening agent that prohibited the defendant exercising some reasonable care from having learned that Howard had held Pete retroactive. The prison law library burned down. He was denied access to the library, not just for a few days, but in this case for 9 months, because his 974-06 motion that we contend he ought to have raised the Pete Howard nexus claim in was filed 9 months after the decision. But we don't know in this case whether he did. I guess what I'm saying here is the defendant will have an opportunity, in our view, to assert in support of his claim that there was a sufficient reason why I couldn't have raised it earlier. The defendant can assert what that reason was, but that it ought not be simply, oh, I didn't learn of it. Because if I didn't learn of it becomes sufficient, then I think we have the problem that Justice Wilcox was heading towards, which is, wouldn't we have a situation in which piecemeal litigation occurs over years whenever a defendant can subjectively say, oh, I just discovered this rule. Now, maybe I could have discovered it 4 or 5 years ago, but I did just discover it. And it will be extraordinarily difficult for the state to ever defend or challenge the subjective assertion that I just learned of something.
Of course, my concern before was that the defendant has every incentive imaginable to learn of it as soon as possible, that is, to get out as soon as possible, I would sense.
One would hope. But I think one way that cuts both ways. Under those circumstances, then, I think it would be perfectly legitimate to ask of Mr. Thornton, why was it that he didn't learn of the Howard decision until 9 months later? Is there something that kept him from knowing about it?
Okay, counsel, fair enough. And you've several times emphasized 9 months later, 9 months later. Is your position different if it's 9 days later?
Sure. Of course. Of course it would be.
And why?
Because it seems to me that even for counsel, let's put this in the context of a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Would it be ineffective assistance of counsel for an attorney 9 days after this court rendered a decision not to have known about it? Not necessarily. I can't say as a matter of law. We know under the Strickland test for assessing ineffective assistance of counsel that we need to look at whether the performance or the non-performance, the non-recognition of a new decision constituted deficient performance. Is that conduct below a reasonable level of professional performance that we ought to hold all attorneys to? It may be that during the 9 days after the decision came down, the lawyer was incapacitated and incapable of knowing that a new decision had come down. Reasonableness under these circumstances will very likely depend upon the particular facts of each case. And it would be difficult to say that as a matter of law, and we're not saying that as a matter of law, a defendant 9 days, 10 days, 6 months after his decision came down must be held, a reasonable defendant would have been, the law ought to say a reasonable defendant should have known. But the point is, I think those matters have to be thrashed out in each case. What Mr. Hennick wants to do is to say, no, it'll never matter whether he could have. What will be controlling is his allegation that I didn't, an allegation that will almost be impossible for the state ever to contest.
Mr. Ganser, Is Mr. Thornton eligible for parole at some point?
Yes, he will. And, Your Honor, I don't know what his parole eligibility or mandatory. Mr. He's been paroled.
He has been paroled?
Remember, he was sentenced a long time ago. It took a while for this issue to come up.
I was going to suggest that if there had been a parole hearing, he could take a transcript of Assistant Attorney General William Gansner's remarks about 4.5 years and present that to the parole board. But you indicate he's already been paroled?
What would the parole board do?
I can't answer that question. I haven't even thought about it. I don't know whether the parole board should or does, or it's debatable, have the authority under these sort of circumstances to make a discretionary determination that parole should be granted earlier or that parole should be terminated earlier. I don't know.
Certainly can't get rid of the conviction.
No, they can't overturn the conviction, and I suspect from past dealings with the Department of Corrections that they're a little reluctant to just chop off time on the end of a sentence in the absence of a judicial order. But there perhaps could have been something that they could have done in terms of the granting of discretionary parole. I was unaware of what Mr. Thornton's circumstances were now.
If you can't chop off the conviction, would it have an effect later on habitual or recidivism and increased sentencing?
I don't think so.
Guidelines,
no. If we were operating under the federal sentencing guidelines, and gratuitously I will say thank goodness we are not, it might make a difference. But I don't think under existing Wisconsin sentencing law it would make a difference.
Judge wouldn't consider it?
Well, I don't think we have repeat. I don't think there's a sentence enhancer for the second commission of a crime that was earlier, where a sentence was earlier enhanced by use of a gun. So I don't know that it would.
Now, you keep talking about 9 months. You're referring to Thornton's second 974-6 motion?
Yes, the one he filed in April of 98, 9 months after the Supreme Court ruled in Howard that Pete was retroactive.
Did you object in the Circuit Court or the Court of Appeals that he could not add the issue of Pete Howard?
I believe this case was decided. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Did we, on his appeal from the denial of his 974-06?
He went back to, as I understand it, he went to the Court of Appeals.
Yes.
And
appealing from the denial of his second 974-06.
Did he raise there this Pete Howard issue? Didn't he ask that it be remanded?
He didn't raise it there. He raised in several motions. He attempted to assert it. Matter of fact, he attempted to assert it in the first place in the Circuit Court in June, I believe, on a motion to vacate. But that motion was brought after the court had already summarily denied his 974-06 motion. Yet clearly, what we have here is a situation where the defendant got caught up in this web of that I think might very well have entangled an attorney. Who's got jurisdiction? Circuit Court, Court of Appeals. The important point I wanted to emphasize, Your Honor, if I could, though, is that at the Court of Appeals, he was given the choice by the Court of Appeals. Proceed with your appeal now, or go back to the Circuit Court and bring a new 974-06 motion. We're not sure, the Court said, that the Circuit Court would be obligated to consider it. I think they were suggesting a possible Escalona problem here, but they said, you have a choice. You can pursue your appeal, or you can go back and bring a 974-06 motion. He equivocated, and then he chose to go with the appeal.
Well, I'm looking at page 7 of your brief, and you're saying, and one of the reasons, and I do appreciate the brief setting forth these facts in such detail and in this order, because it's very easy to follow. But then, so I'm sorry, I may be wrong, since you have roughly four or five 974-06s here.
Yes.
It says, Thornton, this is what the court said.
This is page
the Court of Appeals, page 7. The last four lines of that first paragraph. Thornton may be able to raise this as an issue in the Circuit Court after disposition of the appeal, however. To me, that does not square with what you just said.
I think what the Court of Appeals was suggesting, Your Honor, is that while the Court was unable to determine at that point whether the validity of any or the effectiveness, the efficacy of any sufficient reason he might raise, I think what the Court was saying was there is a possibility that even after this appeal is done, if you have a sufficient reason for not having raised the issue before, you can present it in a
Right, but court. I heard you say, and I could be wrong, Mr. Gansner, that the Court of Appeals gave him a choice of continuing with the appeal or going back to the Circuit Court.
Yeah, I think I think I may have understated the choice that he was given.
Okay,
I
mean, that will be in the record.
I think he was actually had three choices. The first two were, you can, if you want to pursue this motion you're telling us about right now, you can go back and do it, and we won't go ahead with your appeal. Or you can go ahead with the appeal and not do the motion. By the way, footnote, you may be able to present this motion later after this appeal is over. So I think he was given a full panoply of choices here. The one he chose, and I don't attach any particular significance to this other than to say, I think this is frankly a defendant who understood the opportunities he had, and chose to pursue one particular one. I don't think that means anything about his ability or knowledge of the law, other than he was perfectly capable of exercising a rational choice, and he did.
Did the state object in the Court of Appeals to Mr. Thornton's raising this issue?
No.
Court of Appeals did it sua sponte?
I'm positive that the Mr. Hinnick can't support me on this because he wasn't representing Mr. Thornton at the time. But I'm pretty certain that I, as counsel for the state at that point, I was not filing oppositions to what the defendant was asking for, because it clearly seemed to me that it was a matter within the discretion of the Court of Appeals.
Why was it in the discretion if Escalona would have put it as not able to do it? Or is your position that in that first, in that second, I'm sorry, second 974-06, he could have raised that issue because it was after Howard.
Yeah. Here's the situation. When a defendant file, when a pro se defendant files a 974-06 motion and alleges, I have a sufficient reason, my sufficient reason is X, Y, or Z, and the court, circuit court, summarily deals with the matter, the state is seldom granted an opportunity even to address that question. But the point more significant is this, that if a defendant alleges a sufficient reason, our view generally would be the defendant is allowed to present the argument on what the sufficient reason is in the circuit court. And then it'll be determined whether that does, in fact, constitute a sufficient reason. Mm-hmm. If a defendant has brought 10 post-conviction motions and burdened the circuit court and possibly the Court of Appeals with a series of motions and appeals, that still does not eliminate the possibility that he might eventually have a sufficient reason for presenting some new claim. And thus, those are matters that I think need to be considered by the circuit court. And in that respect, if I could just make one last observation, Mr. Hinnick, in his brief, has used a term that was clever, and I wish I had thought of it, referring to the state's position as finality uber alles. I began hearing tubas. The point is this. This is not a case where we are forced to choose. Well, on the particulars of Mr. Thornton's case, we've already acknowledged, if he's allowed to make this claim, he gets some time knocked off his sentence, yes. But in the larger sense of what we are doing, what the court is being asked to do in creating precedent, this court should not view this as a situation where it is being asked to choose between fairness to potentially innocent defendants and the state's rigid adherence to finality. That is not the case. Like the federal system, where even in the presence of a procedural default in the state courts, that would, under most circumstances, bar the defendant from raising the issue in federal court. If the defendant is asserting a claim of actual innocence, the procedural default is put aside. In Wisconsin, a defendant who is able to discover, through newly discovered evidence or newly revealed evidence, a basis for a claim demonstrating his innocence, can clearly bring that motion at any time. Number one, we've got a well-established precedent saying a new trial on the grounds of newly discovered evidence, if it is in fact newly discovered, can be raised at any time. And we've got established case law saying that that would be appropriate under 974-06 as well. It would be difficult to imagine a better, more deserving instance of a sufficient reason why I ought to be allowed to raise a new claim than I just discovered the DNA evidence shows that I'm not guilty. We're not saying here that the state's interest in finality precludes a defendant who is able to pursue a claim of actual innocence from doing so. That's not what we're seeking.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Hennig.
Just a couple of things. First, to clarify exactly what the court is to decide here. There's been a lot of discussion about, you know, fairness and this balance between finality and fairness and justice. And if this were an issue of first impression or in the federal court where the abuse of discretion standard is totally judge-made law, this court may be free to adopt the state's proposal of a cause of prejudice standard. However, that's not what is before the court. What we have is a statute that the legislature enacted in 1969 with a specific purpose. And that purpose was to equate the sufficient reason standard with the then existing standard for abuse of discretion applied by the U.S. Supreme Court in Favinoia and Sanders. If this court were free to reweigh that balance, the legislature in 69 made a certain balance between finality and fairness and chose a deliberate bypass rule of Favinoia. If this court were free to come up with its own standard, I concede that it could do that. It could adopt the U.S. Supreme Court's current standard or that current balance of the cause and prejudice rule. But I submit to the court that it is not its job at this point to come up with a new standard. Its job at this point is to determine what the legislature intended in 1969. And when you look at the legislative history of 974.06 sub 4 and subsection 8 of the Uniform Post-Conviction Procedure Act, it is clear exactly what the legislature intended in this case. Second, this is not the court referred to the subjective standard as being hard to assess, but I would submit that finding facts is exactly what the circuit court is intended for. It is to determine whether something is in fact true or not. And so the other point there is that the sufficient reason standard does not even apply unless the defendant could have raised the issue on a prior motion. So if you take the sufficient reason standard and turn that into an objective rule, then you effectively have written 974.06 sub 4, at least the sufficient standard except or sufficient reason exception, out of the book. If it only applies when you could have raised it before, and there is no sufficient reason if you could have raised it before, then it's redundant and you turn it into a nullity. And the subjective standard is also fully consistent with Howard. It is fully consistent with this court's discussion of sufficient reason in Escalon and Araño. Unlike in Escalon and Araño, but like the defendant in Howard, Mr. Thornton did not know the legal basis for his claim at the time of his prior post-conviction motion. Unlike Escalon and Araño, and like Howard, he did not raise it in his prior motion. Unlike Escalon and Araño, and like Howard, he has sufficient reason for raising it now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Hennick, and thank you, Mr. Gansner, for once again discussing Escalon and Araño with this court. Mr. Hennick, were you appointed through our appellate pro bono procedure? Thank you for appearing in both and for both representations, Mr. Gansner, and thank you. That ends our proceeding on 01-1402, State versus Thornton. The court is in recess until 1:30. The student should remain here, and Justice Saprasa will be out momentarily. We are in recess.